to episode 317 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley,
Ash Baker,
Nathan Smith.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we'll be continuing our Agnes Varda series with a pair of her LA documentaries. First, 1968's Black Panthers, and second, 1981's Murmurs, or Murals. but it's really fun to just say Murmurs. It sounds like you're like having a stroke. real quickly, head over to cinematary.com. We got a cool little thing. Miranda Barnwall did a recap on this new TCM project that's happening, Women Make Film, which is a kind of a roadmap through the cinematic history of women in film history. So check that out. We also have Michael's review of I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which we talked about last week, as well as a review of Bill and Ted Face the Music. And then we'll also have, I swear it's not like a, you know, like I have like a ego complex, but you'll have a recap of the Toronto Film Festival coming from just me. I'm going to go over a couple titles right now, but we'll have that coming up very soon. But yeah, let's go ahead and jump in the movies that we saw this week. I'm going to do some quick hits on some stuff that I've seen at TIFF. The one thing I'll say, we're going to have, I'll probably talk about it next week with Darren Hughes, but probably one of the better things I've seen so far at TIFF is Nomadland, the new film by Chloe Zhao that stars Frances McDormand. But I know Darren saw that as well, and so I'll save that for next week and we can talk about that. But I did want to highlight a couple that I'd seen that I thought were great. Another one that was probably my favorite is the new film from Tom Moore, who I know Michael is a big fan of his, but animation heads probably are familiar with his work from the animation studio Cartoon Saloon, which is an Irish-based animation studio, and he's produced three, the studio's produced three films, but Tom Moore has directed two so far. There's The Secret of Kells, which is this really wonderful kind of retelling of Irish folklore in the Book of Kells. It has this like really wonderful animation style, but all three of his movies that he's directed have this really wonderful folklorish animation style to it that I really just appreciate a lot. And so there's The Secret of Kells that he did, and then a couple years ago he did a film called The Song of the Sea, which I believe both of those are available on Netflix if you're curious about them. But his latest is called Wolfwalkers. It's probably his most ambitious just in terms of the scope and the runtime and such, because a lot of his movies are usually on the shorter side, but this one takes place in Kilkenny, Ireland, kind of late 1600s, early 1700s, and you have these English settlers who have come to Ireland and are trying to establish the town. Outside of the walls of the town, you have this this lush forest that you have this pack of wolves that are led by these two. They're humans, but they kind of have like this magical element to them known as wolf walkers, and they have the ability to at night they can turn their spirit turns into a wolf, and they're able to kind of roam the forest and everywhere as wolves, and then when they wake up they return to their human forms. And so there's this young wolf hunter, her dad is kind of the chief wolf hunter, who what they're trying to do is the English settlers are trying to clear out all of the foliage, all of the all that magic and superstition out there in nature. And so naturally she links up with the younger wolf walker and is kind of develops this friendship. But like I said at the beginning, it is this kind of, it's much more expansive than a lot of Tom Moore's movies. I really love the animation style. It does, it just has this I mean, the secret of Kells is very much following, like, in that kind of period of time centric art style. And this one seems a little bit more, it's not nearly as, like, stylized as that one is. It's much more closer to the Song of the Sea, his most recent one. But I compared it on, in my, you know, kind of quick thoughts review, it kind of has, like, the scope of something like Pixar's Brave, or I think it's more closely linked with Studio Ghibli's Princess Mononoke, because it kind of has, like, this industry versus nature storyline to it. It literally kind of almost mimics, like, that if you've seen Princess Mononoke, that kind of climax sequence where you have the settlers, like, all going into the forest, and there's, like, these, like, erupting fires and magical beasts and stuff. But I really love the output that Cartoon Saloon has kind of been putting out. I think it's, especially with Studio Ghibli somewhat subsiding and Pixar leaning much more heavily on kind of computer and 3D animation and just retreading, going into sequels and prequels and things of that nature. Cartoon Saloon is very much one that has kind of held true with that hand-drawn style. And this one especially just really feels very original, very, it's not, I wouldn't say it's innovative in terms of, like, the narrative, but there's something really wonderful and free and lively about this story, and especially just the way that it kind of weaves between the hand-drawn animation. Then it also has, like, these kind of almost experimental these experimental moments where you have kind of the spirits that are drifting off throughout the land, and it feels more like, kind of think of the Toccata and Fugue sequence in Fantasia, where you just have, like, the colors and the lines and stuff moving around. It's really beautiful to kind of look at. And so it's coming out later this year on Apple Plus or whatever the hell Apple's streaming thing is. And if you're a fan of his other movies, I would recommend checking it out. And if you have not seen any of Tom Moore's movies, high recommend, and I'm not just saying this because he follows us on Twitter now, but high recommend on checking out his previous two features, as well as the one that he produced called The Breadwinner. I think all of those are available streaming somewhere. But Wolfwalkers was probably one of my favorites. The next one I want to talk about real quickly, unless, Michael, did you have anything you wanted to ask or add on Wolfwalkers?
No, I'm stoked. I'm excited, although I don't have Apple Plus or whatever that is, so I'm going to be waiting for the old Netflix DVD, I guess.
There you go. The next one I want to talk about is a documentary, actually kind of caught spur of the moment, called Inconvenient Indian. It's directed by Michelle Latimer. It's based on the best-selling book, I believe, of the same name, and the author of that book, Thomas King, is used as the narrator throughout the film. So the way it's structured is you have Thomas King, and he's literally, like, riding in a cab through Toronto. And you have this woman who has, like, this very elaborate coyote headdress on. And pretty much the documentary is a mixture of more, you know, prototypical documentary. Like, the whole thesis of it is looking at the modern indigenous person, and kind of looking back also at the pop culture portrayal of indigenous people, both in just kind of on all over North America throughout the 21st century. It looks back, you know, it brings up a lot of the canon of Westerns, the Lone Ranger, just random kind of bonanza, like, TV shows. And so it looks at that, so it shifts between kind of those moments while also kind of it has one moment where it's paralleling, like, what you see in the documentary Nanook of the North to what a much more modern and realized version of like a fishing moment from that documentary, what it looks like in actual, you know, reality. And you have these kind of talking heads, not just Thomas King, but other people who are talking about how because there's so little representation of indigenous people in media, that a lot of people's perceptions of what of their culture and how they act is coming from pop culture. Stuff, you know, something they said, they mentioned Nanook of the North as like kind of the first purveyor of that, because it you know, showed what these people kind of acted like. And they were like, yeah, but that was very, even then, a lot of the stuff that they were portraying was much more prehistoric than what people were actually doing at the time to kind of, you know, get food and just live their lives. And so it does that, but then it also kind of dips into this much more avant-garde, ethereal, kind of spiritual, kind of asides. I don't really know how to describe it, but it's like you kind of float through these moments where you're like seeing images of both modern and pop culture representations of indigenous people, and how those kind of conflate. Like I mentioned, that like the Nanook of the North, like you kind of see this conflation of like what those two visions look like. And then the back half of the documentary is more just the current kind of socio-political fight that a lot of indigenous people are going through. That has this prolonged moment where I think it was in Canada, but it was a confrontation between indigenous people and police at some sort of pipeline there. And it immediately like turns very violent, and it's very stark, because you have like these indigenous people who are, they're like chanting and doing, you know, specific dances, and just kind of, they're not being very confrontational with the police. They're holding their customs at this sacred space. And then it immediately turns kind of violent, and they start pushing people over and shooting tear gas and things of that nature. And it's a very different confrontation than what you're seeing like in the news now, because they're not, you know, they're not even at the level of like people were in like Portland or something, where they were wearing gas masks or stuff of that nature. They're just, you know, getting hit with all this stuff. And so it was interesting. I'll be honest, I'm not super familiar. I mean, I have a decent amount of understanding on just how, at least when it comes to Native Americans in America, the United States, you know, kind of that whole history to a degree. There's a decent amount of education on that in Chattanooga, just because of the Trail of Tears starting there and things of that nature. But I'm pretty unfamiliar on the Canadian side, and that's been something that always kind of jumps out to me when we go to TIFF, is they really like put a big spotlight on that. And so this was kind of an interesting, you know, I think I'm going to check out the book as well, but a nice little primer for, I think, people like me who are maybe not very familiar with what that whole struggle is like. And especially the thing that really kind of stuck with me was they talked about how, you know, if you look at the three most recent generations, the oldest generation was very much like engulfed in the customs. Like they were very traditional. They were kind of taking part in a lot of the customs that you would kind of assume that these various tribes and such took part in. They were much more in line with that. And then you have this middle generation that is the parents of the current generation, and they were much more the generation that was indoctrinated, especially like in America, with like bringing, like, you're going to be brought more into American culture. And they talked about how they were kind of taught to, you know, tamp down a lot of their cultural customs and, you know, rituals and things of that nature, and were adopting Christianity more. And were just, it was pretty much, it was kind of like, don't be so outward with you know, who you are. And that's very much flipping with this most modern generation. And a lot of the younger, indigenous folks who talk in this movie talk about how their parents, they you know, struggle with their parents because their parents still are like in that mindset of like, oh, like you need to kind of keep that at bay. Like people aren't going to accept you if you're going to be, you know, devoutly following that, you know, our more traditional customs, and how there's a big, you know, wellspring of people wanting to bring that back and be much more, you know, much more true to what, you know, what their heritage is, which was really interesting. So Inconvenient Indian, I would recommend that. The other documentary, I have two more documentaries, I guess. That's just been my hit for TIFF so far. The next one is MLK FBI, which is directed by Sam Pollard. And this one looks at the newly declassified files that explores the FBI and U.S. government surveillance and harassment of Martin Luther King Jr. It's one of those things, at least for me, and I was going to write about this in my review, you know, with a lot of these, I thought a lot of... not just necessarily about the subject matter, but I thought a lot about how this compares to something like 13th. And the issue I deal with, or I kind of hit with those is like, is this telling the story? Like, because in both cases, I agree or I'm engaged with the subject matter, but with 13th, my issue was had nothing to do with the subject matter, but was like, this didn't feel very like cinematic to me. It felt, you know, it didn't really feel like a movie or a film or even a document. It just kind of, it felt like a long New Yorker piece, which is not necessarily bad, but I was like, I don't understand why this had to be filmed necessarily. You could have probably done this in a much more, in a different format. And so I was kind of concerned about that being the case with MLK and /FBI, but that really was not the case. So instead, they have a lot of talking heads, but what they do is they show more of like archival footage. They're showing, you know, you're seeing what was happening at that period of time that they're talking about, and then you have people like Andrew Young and folks of that nature who are doing more voiceovers. And so for the majority of the movie, as they're outlining all this stuff, you're pretty much engaged with the content through this archival footage and photos and things of that nature. And at the end, they bring people like in front of the camera and talk more, when it's more of a reflection of what in 2020 are you, you know, do you make of this information? And then a lot of the back half of the movie is about in 2027, how that will be the first year that the actual tapes that the FBI recorded of Martin Luther King Jr. can be declassified. And a lot of those, I mean, they go in depth in the movie about how, I mean, the FBI was just recording just literally every interaction they could of his, including like, you know, him with other women and such, which they have the whole account of like this incredibly fucked up situation where they record him with this woman, and then they like, and then, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, who throughout this entire movie is just, you know, blatantly hating Martin Luther King, like mails that tape with this pretty much, you know, blackmail letter to his wife. And so like that kind of stuff will be declassified. And they were talking about like, what if it will alter your perception of Martin Luther King Jr., which, you know, that's a discussion for maybe another time. To me, that doesn't really affect it at all. You know, I think when people will watch this, there is a lot of relevance to today in terms of just how the government tries to do everything in its power to, because there was really no reason to be doing the level of surveillance they were doing on him, other than they just wanted to suppress his message. And so it's on that sense, it does ring true to today. So I really liked it. I think it does transcend being just like people reading declassified files and such. I think that the personal perspectives of other civil rights activists, along with people who have done extensive research on and biographies and such on Martin Luther King Jr. and J. Edgar Hoover and Bill Sullivan and those folks, is interesting. And so I would recommend that one. I believe it comes out later this year. The last one, and I'll be real quick because I've gone on too long anyway, is I watched this was, and this is, I don't know how you all will feel. This is my first Frederick Wiseman, and I watched City Hall, which on Monday, I don't need like a medal or anything, but I mean, I worked an 8-hour day on Monday, and then I sat and watched 4.5 hours of this City Hall documentary, which is really interesting. I know, Michael and Nathan, I know that you, and maybe Ash too, I don't want to leave you out, but are like fans of his, and so I'd be really curious to talk about what, like this kind of like more extensively about his career and where this fits in. But this was really fascinating to me. I think I'm gonna dive more into this in my written review. So the city it looks at is Boston, which I already rolled my eyes at because I mean, okay, to, at least in my personal opinion, that's not an interesting city to talk about. But I think it looks at it because they're doing all of these very different. So, I mean, it looks at like what it's trying to do, what the city's trying to do to combat racial justice, or, you know, deal with cover racial justice and combat climate change and look at housing and look at all of these various elements. But then you also have this kind of the mayor, Marty Walsh, who, you know, it seems like, again, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like a staple of Wiseman is just to kind of put the camera there and film, and he's not really engaged in what's happening. He's just trying to kind of document it and leave it there. But then you also have like this whole, I mean, he had to have filmed hours and hours and hours of this and then chopped it down to 4.5 hours. So there still is like some sort of personal perception in this. And Marty Walsh is kind of viewed as like this, in the age of Trump, this kind of progressive mayor trying to combat the federal policies in order to make good on a local level, which is fine. But I guess it's more my own personal politics. I don't necessarily agree that what he's doing is all that. It seems more of just kind of posturing. To me, the last thing I'll say, the most, absolutely most interesting part of this movie comes like at the 3.5 hour mark. And there's this public forum between, it's in this kind of economically depressed neighborhood of Boston. I'm not super familiar with the city, so I don't know like the specific name and such, but, and they're opening a cannabis shop, and you have the owners and like the people who invested in the cannabis shop at this table, and they're talking about how it's going to create all these jobs and people can like get involved and learn various, you know, aspects of the industry, and it's going to be this wonderful addition to the neighborhood. And then it opens up to public comment, and you have this incredible back and forth between the people, you know, the owners and investors and such, and these public members who are just outlining, you know, all of these reasons why, you know, we already have, you know, problems with, you know, we don't have anywhere where your customers can park. We have this crime problem here, and this seems like it's just going to kind of you know, add more because it's going to, you know, have more people kind of coming in, just dawdling around the neighborhood. There's not enough, you know, space for this, for what you're kind of planning to, you know, it's just going to take up more home space. There's not going to be enough housing, and there's already not enough housing. And you have like these really well, you know, these very, very passionate citizens outlining like, we don't disagree with you putting this here, but also you need to think of the social ramifications of what you're doing if you put this in this neighborhood. And to me, that was the most inspiring thing. It wasn't like the mayor, you know, alluding to the Trump administration and saying, we're going to, you know, despite what they think about climate, we're going to do this. It was like these citizens who were, they weren't, you know, city council members. They weren't senators. They weren't like public officials. They were just, you know, passionate people in their neighborhood. And they went to this little small public forum about this store opening up, and it was super inspiring. And so I really liked this. And I know that the 4.5 hour thing will probably make people roll their eyes, but I would Clockwork Orange this for people, quite honestly. Like, you should be strapped to a chair and have to watch this. It's such a wonderful microcosm of showing that the city government is not just, you know, the mayor and the city council, but all of these various little committees and groups, you know, having to, you know, talk through issues and vote on things and decide things. It's fascinating. I would force people to watch this, but that's City Hall. That's what I got.
Zach, you should watch At Berkeley, which is like 4 hours of that, but for University of California at Berkeley.
I guess maybe I'm just enough of a wonk with this. I loved every second of this for the most part, because like the homelessness thing was super, like they had this committee that was, you know, working on homelessness in Boston. It was fascinating. So I don't know. My prejudice is I wouldn't have picked Boston. I wouldn't have picked any northern city, quite honestly. I would have found some city that kind of was like teetering on innovating and kind of finding more progressive politics and being much more, you know, right lean for a long time. So I would have found like some southern city.
You got to watch Monrovia, Indiana, then, which I think was his last movie.
All right, and then I'll.
It's not exactly about that, but it's like this kind of smallish Indiana town that's like basically going through demographic change, where it kind of has to face like policy decisions to say like how much they want the town to grow. And you see a lot of meetings having to do with that, and it's really interesting.
Okay, I think I'll like that way more. There's a whole section where they're doing the parade for the Boston Red Sox that I was texting Andrew groaning about. I was like, I don't give a shit about Boston. Fuck this. So it was a very anti-Boston watch, but I've talked way too long. I'll have more in my TIFF coverage. So I'm gonna toss it over to y'all. Michael, you had a movie that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so strap on your time machines, because we're not in 2020 anymore. It's 1928, and we're in France, and this is a silent French film called The Fall of the House of Usher, which is based on the Edgar Allan Poe story of the same name, and it's directed by someone named Jean Epstein, whose work I'm not familiar with, and I think this is that person's most famous film. But it's kind of famous for being a not completely avant-garde treatment of the short story, but like definitely has like those textures. So like for like the first half of the movie, it's like a kind of expressionist film, really shadowy, you know, evocative, like large sets and things like that. But then like as the characters kind of in the story descend into like paranoia and madness, like the style of the film becomes more and more erratic, until by the end it's just kind of like this succession of images that kind of make sense, but more like are there for effect. And it's super cool. The DVD version I watched, which was a DVD from 2001, which I normally wouldn't recommend. You got to find, in the early 2000s weren't like a great time for DVDs, but this film has like two interesting things for this like DVD version. One of which is that this being a French movie, it has French intertitles. And the normal way to do this, if you have like a English language release, would be to have the subtitles for the intertitles. But this one just has like some French guy, like every time a French intertitle comes up, this French guy just reads the English to you, which is really nice, honestly. Like if you don't want to read those intermittent intertitles, then this works. The other cool thing about this version is that there is this musical score that is really, really loud. And I'm not usually like a huge fan of that in silent films, but like this is a really interesting pairing with the movie, because it's like this basically like avant-garde kind of like, I don't know, it sounds like Kraftwerk or some, not exactly like early Kraftwerk or something like that, you know, where they're still kind of weird, like Tangerine Dream, but like before they got all synthy, like krautrock kind of stuff. And it's by this guy named Roland Descandes, or however the French person would pronounce that. But he's like a music historian who apparently like based this score off of like medieval music, but it honestly sounds like an experimental record from like the 1970s, which I think really complements the movie really well, and makes it really interesting, even though it's like 100% anachronistic to like the, you know, the period that the movie was made in. But I totally recommend it. I'm pretty sure you can watch it on YouTube in the same version that I watched. It's only about an hour long. And if you're just kind of itching for that spooky time October vibe a little early this year, I think it's really, really worth a watch.
I think I put that one on Young Critics this past year. I want to say it was that one.
There's, I think there's like two Fall of the House of Usher films in 1928. So, yeah, there's an American one, and then there's this French one.
It was just like the big year for it. They were like, we got to get a bunch.
Yeah, did it like enter the public domain that year or something? but I've not seen the American one, so I can't vouch for it. But this French one is really cool, and I liked it a lot.
All right. Nathan, you had a movie.
Yeah, I just watched the only movie ever directed by the great stand-up comic and American icon Richard Pryor, and that's Jojo Dancer, Your Life is Calling, which is a really essentially autobiographical movie, kind of based off of Pryor's childhood and his sort of struggles to break into show business, and then his kind of eventual spiraling out and just sort of like excessive life as he became a superstar. And it's like very, very faithful to Richard Pryor's life. Back when I was a teen, I was a pretty big stand-up comedy nerd, and I remember reading Richard Pryor's memoir, which is called Pryor Convictions. So a lot of the incidents in this movie were actually like really familiar to me, and I remembered reading them from that book. So I think it is. You know, obviously it's not, you know, the Richard Pryor story. You know, he's playing this version of himself called Jojo Dancer, but it is like very faithful to his life. And Richard Pryor, you know, if you don't know a lot about him, you probably know that he lived a little bit of a wild life. He was born in Ohio, I believe, and his family ran a brothel. So he grew up in a brothel. He was in the army, and there's this amazing anecdote, which unfortunately is not depicted in the movie, but I think bears mentioning because it's about a movie that we've talked about on the podcast pretty recently. But when Richard Pryor was in the army, they had a screening for the troops, you know, at like whatever base he was at of Douglas Sirk's Imitation of Life. And he was like really profoundly moved by it. And some soldier nearby was just like laughing at it and making fun of the movie. And so Richard Pryor stabbed him. So, you know, you get a lot of kind of like really sort of wild incidents in this movie. Basically, it's based off of an incident in the early 1980s when kind of at the height of Pryor superstardom, but also at the height of his drug addiction and sort of like personal struggles. In the early 1980s, while smoking crack, he lit himself on fire. So this movie begins with this comic, Jojo Dancer, smoking crack, just like totally bottoming out and lighting himself on fire. And he goes into a coma. His sort of spirit leaves his body and then goes through his entire life. And it's like sort of a Bob Fosse, all that jazz type movie, you know, this sort of tragic artistic figure kind of looking back on his life and the mistakes that he's made and sort of wrestling with all of this guilt and all of this self-loathing. But it's also, you know, like a Bob Fosse movie, it's a really kind of incredible document of performance. You see Richard Pryor sort of revisiting all of these various stages of his career. You know, you see him like honing his act very early on in like sparsely attended jazz clubs. There's a fucking amazing scene where he does this like extended burlesque drag striptease in a nightclub, and it's like, when I say extended, I mean this is like this thing, this, you know, he's like in drag for like just like minutes on end. And Richard Pryor, like, honestly looks pretty good in drag, like, if I'm being honest. And so then, you know, from there it kind of goes, you know, up to like the bigger clubs, and you see him doing versions of actual Richard Pryor bits. And some of these, like, some of the stand-up that he does in this movie is, I think, even better than like the actual recordings or videotape that's out there of real Richard Pryor performances. Like, this, there's this amazing routine he does about taking acid at a party that just like had me in stitches. So not only is this like a really great, you know, sort of faux biopic, it's also just this like incredible document of a of an artist and a performer. And it's a very, like, it's got a really nice sort of directorial touch to it. You know, I mentioned Bob Fosse, but it also reminds me a little bit of Albert Brooks, a little bit of Charles Burnett even. You know, it has this sort of magical realist quality to it, but it's also like a really interesting sort of period piece over a manner of decades. There's like the most amazing Marvin Gaye needle drop I think I've ever seen in a movie. This just like incredible montage that's like following Richard Pryor as he's getting bigger and bigger, and as he's going from smaller clubs to larger clubs while What's Going On plays. I had wanted to see this movie for a long time as a fan of Pryor's comedy. I really think that, like, you know, he's very unmatched. I think in stand-up comedy there are very few who are like on his level of just like wit and vocal ability, but also like, you know, physical performance. He's an incredible full-bodied performer. I'd wanted to see this for a long time, and I was, you know, as I hope to be, I was really blown away by it, both by his performance but also his direction. So whether or not you are like really familiar with Richard Pryor, I really recommend that you check out this movie, because I think it works both for, you know, somebody who knows his life, knows his stories, knows his career, but it's also like an introduction, I think, too, if you're not as familiar with his body of work. And it's on the Criterion Channel right now. It's kind of been a harder movie to find for a long time, so it's, it makes me really happy that it's just like so readily available, because I think it really deserves to be seen.
Cool. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, check it out on the Criterion Channel. Ash, take us home.
So I watched a movie called Man and Chicken.
Yeah.
So I've been working my way through, after watching Hannibal, the television show, I've been working my way through Mads Mikkelsen's filmography, because I think he's cute and sexy. And, so he's in this Danish movie, because he's Danish, from 2015, called Men and Chicken. And he's
two great tastes that taste great together.
Yes. So the director, Anders Thomas Jensen, Mads Mikkelsen has been in a lot of his movies. I've only seen three of them. I really enjoyed, I'm talking about Men and Chicken because it was probably the strangest movie I've seen this year. But Flickering Lights is another movie by Anders Thomas Jensen with Mads Mikkelsen in it. And I thought it was like a really fantastic movie, and I loved it. So if you want like a genuinely good time, a nice dark comedy, Danish dark comedy, watch Flickering Lights. It's very cute and funny. But Men and Chicken is weird. Well, so you're starting out and you're watching a movie called Men and Chicken, and so you're like, okay, what is this? And what it is a movie about two brothers. The main brother is played by, this guy named David Densick. I think that's how you say it. He's been in some, American movies. I didn't recognize his face, even though I've seen him in some movies before, but it's probably just because I have a bad memory. But he was very good. But he plays the main brother, and the other brother is Mads Mikkelsen. And sort of from the start, you're like, okay, something is going on in this movie. So Mads Mikkelsen plays a character who's like mentally handicapped brother of this guy. And in the beginning of the movie, they find out that they were adopted. And so they go to try to find their biological family. And so they take a trip down to like this rural part of whatever country they're in, wherever they speak Danish, and I guess Dane Denmark. Land. Yeah. And so they go to this rural area, and so they just sort of hear rumors like your real dad, he is a scientist and sort of a recluse, and he did all these experiments, and like you two actually have two different moms, you're only half brothers, and so they go to this house where they believe they'll find their biological father, and they're greeted by three men around their age who, for lack of a better analysis, just look inbred. And the movie sort of hints towards this and like wants you to, you know, come to this conclusion, and they're like, we'll let you talk to dad, but later, he's sick right now. Why don't you just hang out with us? And there's like, the house is just like trashed. There's like animals everywhere. And they're like, yes, you may fuck any of the animals that you like, except for the bull. The bull is special. And you're just like, what is going on in this movie? But the way that the movie was made, it's just like, I was so intrigued the entire time because I literally had no idea what was going to happen next. But every time the thing that happened next happened, I was like, what the fuck is happening right now before my eyes? Ultimately, didn't enjoy the movie. Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what you mean by enjoy. It was just a strange movie, you know? I would say it's definitely a miss in the realm of movies. In the end, can I spoil this movie for the Cinematary crowd? So,
please.
Spoiler. What had actually happened is they weren't inbred. All of the brothers actually were the result of an experiment by the father. They were all some percentage between 8 and 15% animal of some kind. So,
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, it was really wild. They
Ash,
yeah.
I know you're an X-Files fan. Is this not an episode of the X-Files? Like, isn't there that one where the guy has been doing experiments and has, like, crossbred them with animals?
Wait a second.
It's the Frankenstein homage, I think. Like, the black and white one. Anyway, this isn't important. This is Cinematary, not TV material.
No, but I do... I don't remember that. I do remember the really, like, tasteless episode with, like, the... with like the family that's like been inbreeding.
Oh, and they kept their mom under the bed and everything.
Yeah, that was a terrible episode. And I was like thinking about that and I was like, oh God, please don't let it be that one episode of the X-Files. And it wasn't, although it was like just as strange. I don't remember that one episode, but I'm sure I'm just forgetting it. Anyway, it was very strange. Mads Mikkelsen was like great as usual, and I'm very excited to see his new movie, which I'm jealous Zach is going to see very soon.
We're gonna take a short break, and then as I work out my parole, we'll return with part two to talk about two Agnes Varda LA-based documentaries after this.
Hello, this is Michael O'Malley with Cinematary. We wanted to use the midpoint of this week's episode to direct you to the rest of what the website and podcast have to offer. First, if you're a fan of what Cinematary is doing, please consider joining us on Patreon. For $5, you're able to get exclusive content from our staff, including our Film Theory and Chill series, where a panel takes a piece of theory every month and deconstructs it before diving into whatever topic is on their mind from the past week. The $5 each month is an investment in the website and the podcast that goes solely to paying our writers for their reviews each week, so consider it as a gift to their hard work. If you miss an episode of Cinematary or a piece of writing we had, consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each Sunday, we send out a note with the latest podcast episode, a piece of Patreon content, and the last two reviews written at cinematary.com. It's perfect for those interested in what's happening, but might be too busy to see the posts when they go up. And finally, the easiest thing you can do to support the site is to give us a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. This helps with getting more eyeballs on the podcast and website and extends our exposure. Plus, it's free. So to recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and give us a rating or review. Thanks for listening, and now back to the show.
And we're back with part two of episode 317 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be talking about two Los Angeles-based documentaries by Agnes Varda. The first is 1968's Black Panthers. Varda and her crew shot the film in 1968 during her time in California, while her husband Jacques Demy was in Hollywood working on Model Shop. She directed two documentaries on the Black Panthers in 1968. Huey captures the militant atmosphere of the Free Huey campaign, whereas Black Panthers focuses on its local impact on the African-American community of Oakland. The two films have generated a confusion, which more often than not has passed unnoticed in Agnes Varda's filmography. Huey and Black Panthers are mistakenly referred to as the French and English versions of the same film, although they encompass two distinct projects. Huey's raw black and white footage strives to convey an inside view of the Black Panther Party as Varda attended the 1968 rally in an attempt to better understand the ideological underpinning of the movement, whereas Black Panthers' colored images highlight the party's everyday activities, enhancing the role of the African-American woman engaged in the fight for collective rights and the police-targeted communities. While Huey's film discourse relies on editing only, Black Panthers includes an explanatory voiceover giving informative details and framing the Panthers' project in a sympathetic light. Film critic David James blames Varda with, quote, almost producing them, the Black Panthers, as the exotic natives of an ethnographic documentary. The scholar contends that as a white French director, Varda could not but depict the group from an outsider's perspective, expressing her fascination with the, quote, racial other represented by the men in the Panther Party. Communication scholar Jane Rhodes said, quote, the Panthers were fit into narrow unidimensional frames that told the public little about why the organization existed, its appeal to black youth across the nation, or its relationship to the nation's racial crisis. The author argues that the Panthers' confident and defiant looks embodied by Newton's bravado and arrogance undermine the visibility of the party's political program while reviving racial stereotypes of blackness. Quote, although their platform was indistinct, what they represented was not these visual and verbal images tapped into white Americans' primal fears of black male sexuality. On that note, let's talk a little bit about Black Panthers, the documentary. Had any of you all seen this before? And, I don't know, it seems like a, prescient time to be watching this documentary. So, Michael, I'll start with you. What did you make of this?
I hadn't seen it before. Some of the footage looked familiar, which made me feel like I maybe had seen it in clips, like in other movies or in other documentaries or something. But maybe I'm just blurring things together. But I really liked it. I think it's always cool to see, like, just a more humanized side of, like, honestly, any part of, like, 60s counterculture, since that's so, like, mythologized. But specifically, you know, Black Panthers, because they were, you know, were and still are kind of like, you know, the subject of a lot of fear-mongering and, you know, misinformation and stuff like that, when a lot of people talk about them. And I don't know, I just, you know, like a lot of Varda documentaries, I guess I've only seen a handful, but like the other Varda documentaries that I've seen, I just really like the spectrum of, like, human life captured on here. Like, and obviously here specifically in the context of the Black Panther Party, but, like, it's just kind of fun seeing all these different people and, like, their personalities all, like, kind of rubbing against one another, like, for this, like, common cause. And I think that's just, like, a really, like, enjoyable project in, like, any context. And then specifically, I mean, this is just subject matter I'm interested in anyway. So I liked it, and it's just, like, half an hour. So that's a nice, breezy, interesting watch. Breezy is maybe the wrong word since it's, like, about serious subject matter. But, like, you know what I mean.
Yeah. Ash, what about you?
Yeah, I'd never seen this either. It, I thought it was really good. I thought it was interesting, especially, I feel like a few months ago, maybe, I watched, the Black Power mixtape, which was, I feel like maybe I'm getting it mixed up with another documentary, but I feel like that's the one that was made by Swedish immigrants, or not immigrants, but like a Swedish documentary team. So I thought it was kind of funny that, like, the two documentaries I've seen kind of following Black Panther activities are from, like, groups outside of the US. But I also just really enjoyed, like, in this, as opposed to in, that documentary, there were a lot of the, like, actual, I guess, like, chants and stuff. The chants I really enjoyed, and that was something that I had not, seen depicted in other documentaries. And so that was, something I enjoyed. And, you know, getting, like, the speech from Stokely Carmichael and, getting the interview in prison, with, Huey Newton. And, yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Nathan, what about you?
Yeah, I hadn't also not seen this. And, you know, you mentioned that scholar saying that this sort of had an exoticizing gaze. And I think that coming into the movie, I was really a little bit nervous about that. You know, Varda, just, again, not just being a white filmmaker, but being a European filmmaker as well, I think places her outside of the, you know, the context of this, obviously. And, you know, like with the voiceover, I could see the sort of comparison to like ethnographic filmmaking. But I think that one of the really worthwhile things about this documentary is that it approaches the Black Panther Party in such good faith, which is just like in such obvious contrast to how so much American media has engaged with and depicted the Black Panther Party, you know, since their inception. And so, you know, she, I think, gives a useful platform and lets, you know, all of the interview subjects, you know, from Huey Newton to Catherine Cleaver, you know, she lets all of these people, I think, really speak and really get at the Black Panther program. And I think there's just like a lot of really interesting things about just the context that this documentary gives you, because I think there's just like so much misinformation about, you know, the Black Panther Party and the more radical wing of the civil rights struggle. And I think that I really like here just how it emphasizes the sort of the revolutionariness of the party, and that, you know, that this isn't just like something that, you know, the Black Panthers weren't just worried about America and weren't just worried about the domestic struggle, that this kind of went beyond just like what we normally think of as like the 50s, 60s into the 70s civil rights struggle. You know, this was really an internationalist group that was looking beyond the borders of the United States, that was looking to China and to Cuba and to Africa, and you know, throughout Latin America. It was really looking to align itself with those communist revolutionary struggles. And so I appreciate that, you know, that this movie is very upfront about kind of identifying that part of the Panther program, and also explicitly identifying it as a communist organization, as a Marxist-Leninist organization, and not shying away from that. I think that an American filmmaker might have obscured that a little bit, but I think that Varda being French, and, you know, France being a place where the Communist Party has been much more visible and active and not quite as stamped out as it was in the United States, I think that there's kind of an interesting context there that she might have that an American filmmaker might not have. You know, there's one part where there's like a young woman in the party talking about their sort of political education program, and she even mentions, you know, she's saying, you know, we're thinking about, like, you know, all of these other countries, and she even mentions, like, you know, like, you know, we're connected with what's happening in France. And obviously 1968 being the big year of the May 68 protests and the student uprisings in France, I think it's really interesting in Varda coming to the U.S. seeing that kind of international alignment.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that last week, because one sings the other doesn't kind of encompasses a little bit of that to an extent. I forgot, there's this line that she has where she's kind of doing her little voiceover, where she's like the panther as like an animal is, you know, it never attacks, but it is very aggressive in its defense. And I feel like that's such a, like, an interesting way to, like, and she does it very early on, like an interesting way to frame the whole, you know, the whole kind of the party's motives, I guess, as a whole. This is the second time I'd seen it. I actually had seen it a couple months ago, when I think it first came on Criterion Channel, and I watched it then. And that was, I kind of had the same reservations as you, Nathan, where I was concerned about this white European filmmaker, despite, you know, feeling like if it, you know, out of anybody, Agnes Varda is probably going to come with good intentions as a director, but there is just, you know, there's something about that. But at the same time, yeah, I agree, like the way it portrays the party is, you know, vastly different than anything you'll see, not only just like in like, you know, national news coverage and things of that nature from the time, but also, you know, you think of like the small Black Panther segment and something like Forrest Gump, just on like on a pop culture level. Like there's not, you know, it's kind of always played very much either at a distance or it's demonized. And so I don't know, Michael Ash, was that something that kind of was in the back of y'all's mind when you were approaching the documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I like that. And I think also too, another thing that happens, and this is true in like leftist discourse as well, is like a lot of times the Black Panther Party is kind of, eulogized in its in media, right? So it's like a thing that happened and it is over now, right? So you hear about like the stuff that like, you know, kind of ends it, like some of the inter-party dynamics or like the like straight up like murders that happened of like Fred Hampton and that sort of thing, you know, at the hands of the police. And like that's all like real relevant history, but like there's something really vibrant and alive that like it was captured kind of at like, you know, whatever like lightning moment where this was like, you know, an operating like community and a movement. And you have like the Free Huey stuff, that kind of like, and the shattered glass, or not the shattered, the broken glass at the end, you know, by the police, that's kind of foreshadowing like the future of the party. But like, it's not, it's made, it's a movie that's made in like the present tense about the Black Panthers, as opposed to the past tense, which I think is like exceedingly rare in like any depictions I've ever seen of the Black Panthers. And I really like that, in addition to like you guys mentioned, the kind of good faith engagement with like the party's ideas and like the way that it doesn't like, you know, prefigure a response to their ideology either. But I really just like the, like how of the moment it was. So where you get to see it without like without any sort of hindsight, which I think is
well, cool. And also, I mean, you mentioned this before, Michael, but I agree. There was something like genuine about it. You know, I think a lot of the times, not only just in kind of fictionalized narrative accounts, you know, like a movie or television version, but even just kind of looking back, there is like this almost filter, this aesthetic, this kind of, you know, musical choice, all this different stuff that kind of is encompassed when you look at like the activism of like the 60s and 70s in America. You know, I, again, not to go back to Forrest Gump, but it feels like you have to like have like Fortunate Son like blaring and like peace signs everywhere. Like there just seems to be like this almost mythical quality to it. And what I really appreciated about the documentary is that, I mean, granted, it's happening within that time, so there's not really any way to mythologize in any, but there's something kind of refreshing about it just being portrayed matter of fact, which I don't feel like, that's just something you don't see just in general about that period of time.
Yeah, I think that like that you have just a general tendency with depictions of leftist organizing in the 60s and 70s, and not even depictions of, but just sort of the way people talk about it. You know, it says this like failed project as something that needs to be mourned, as opposed to like something that is still living in a sense and can still be learned from. You know, I think that people always take like the, you know, like you were saying, sort of saying, Michael, I think people take the Black Panther Party as like a cautionary tale, when I think there's like, you know, a lot that can very actively be learned from it. And I appreciate just the, you know, you said, Zach, this film has a sort of matter of factness, and I appreciate that, like, just the way that it applies that to sort of all of the facets of the party. You know, I think that we get that very neutered view of their sort of work and what they were doing, but this is sort of upfront and direct about everything. You know, it's sort of upfront about their relationship with arms and their feelings about self-defense, and it doesn't shy away from that, but it doesn't necessarily demonize that either. And again, it's like, you know, very sort of upfront about the group being, you know, being, you know, a revolutionary communist organization. There's that, like, I really like that, like, quick little montage of just like different shots of different members of the party holding the little red book, you know, the book of Chairman Mao's quotations. And so just kind of like, I think that's something that's really written out of the party's history too, or is really dampened, at least in the sort of popular depictions. You know, it's just like, oh, they were like the most radical extremist wing of the civil rights movement, not, you know, they were like a revolutionary communist Marxist-Leninist vanguard. I think that there's just been so much red scare and so much you know, communist phobia throughout decades of American history and cultural discourse, that's kind of been really written out of their story too.
All right. The next one from 1981 is Murmurs or Mural Murals. The vast majority of the scenes of the film are shot of murals, all of which are located in the city of Los Angeles, often with the mural's painter or model staged in front of the mural for dramatic effect. The film alternates between voiceover narration by Varda and commentary about the murals provided by the mural's creators, as well as commentary provided by locals living in the area. The film also includes several musical performances, including the Chicano punk band Los Illegals. Mural Murals was produced by Varda alongside Document Tour, a motion picture, a drama film about a French woman living in Los Angeles set against the same murals that are the subject of this film and starring several of the people who worked on this film. In 1979, Varda was living in Los Angeles writing a screenplay when she started to explore murals with friends Denise Warren and filmmaker Alan René. Quote, "I thought it was a very interesting movement. At that time, nobody knew there were murals, but nobody spoke about them. We just went around taking pictures, investigating with the neighbors. Do you know who did that? When?" Varda tracked down the muralist to ask if they would speak on camera. Quote, "I wanted to show how a city can express itself. It's really telling a lot about politics, about the situation, about the segregation. Obviously, there are no murals in Bel Air." Isabel Rojas Williams, who is now the executive director of the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, talking about the film. "At the time she made the movie, she was talking about freedom of expression. She was showing a glimpse of who we were, the freedom of painting murals in the streets from Venice to East Los Angeles. So to me, we are recovering that. Seeing this movie today is like the cherry on top." In 1981, the New York Times said, "Mirrors is entertaining when it simply presents the paintings an artist without too much commentary, when the camera simply gazes on these enormous murals and lets the viewer examine them slowly. It is doing more than enough. However, Ms. Varda includes many observations on the order of, quote, of course, woman is always a rose in the cliche garden of the tough guy's heart." So yeah, on that note, let's talk a little bit about Murals. I really enjoyed this movie a lot. I mean, it was kind of set up for me, at least in terms after, especially after the first 10 minutes or so, I was like, yeah, this is going to play well for me. I have a lot of friends here in Savannah who are either public art muralists themselves or are advocates for it. And so we have long conversations about seeing stuff like of this scale in this movie, like around town. And so I was like, yeah, this is wonderful to see a lot of this kind of, you know, public expression around Los Angeles. And so I'll admit it was kind of a long day. And so I snoozed a little bit during this, but it was one of those, I don't know, I think we've had these conversation before. It was like a nice, like, this movie is incredibly comforting to me. And so I'm going to like snooze for a little bit. So that's my high recommendation on Murals. What about you all, Ash? What did you think?
I kind of agree. I enjoyed it overall, but it did sort of sink into a rhythm after a while of just sort of, you know, moving along to like the next mural or the next style of mural or the next sort of like depiction or representation. There were a couple, though, of the muralists or the like, I guess just like background stories behind the murals that were just like wildly interesting to me. There were the couple of like sort of wacky Christian dudes, which was really crazy. Like one of them was like, "Here's my depiction of Christ. It's my friend Paul."
Yeah.
And it's just like literally his friend Paul in like a pair of blue jeans, and it's just this guy, like a white guy, and you're like, okay.
Was that the one with the guys like, I let him wear my Air Force tie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, even crazier, like in that mural, the god is like modeled after the Lone Ranger actor, because he's like, no one's seen the face of God and lived, and no one's seen the face of the Lone Ranger and lived either.
Right. And he's like, oh, and Christ has the hands of a motorcyclist or something like that. It's like, dude, like, what acid are you tripping right now, my guy? And then the other Christian guy is like also like tripping balls. He's like, yes, I paint because I am an evangelical Christian, and I'm here to tell the good news of the end times and the, you know, that we're all safe because Jesus is coming and we're living in the end times. And I'm like, oh God. And he's like painted the cosmos, and it's like, oh my God, this guy. And he's like a juggler. This is the juggler guy. You know from the start that he's going to be a whack. And then he's like, yes, end times. And you're like, oh my God. But genuinely my favorite was the guy who painted the, well, I guess there were multiple, there was more than one guy who painted about gang violence, but the one who painted the mural that was like in memory of a homeboy, this particular mural, and this guy, the one who sang a song, I thought he was really great.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're I remember who you're talking about now.
He's singing that song under his mural, and he's like, homeboys. He's singing the song about homeboys. He was awesome.
Michael, what about you?
I really liked it, too. I kind of dug the Christian dudes just because, like, I feel like you gotta really lay bare, like, just how weird evangelical Christians are. Like, evangelical Christians have took over our culture and convinced everyone that they're just a bunch of suits. And there kind of are at times, but there's some weird stuff there. So I appreciate that it just is like, you know, no holds barred as far as just the weird stuff there. Like on a macro level, I just like this kind of movie, and I said this kind of about the Black Panther Party too, but or the Black Panthers movie too, but I just like the idea of like capturing a community through like just a series of like vignettes of like different people who are in this community. And so in this one, it's like an artistic community, and there's just like this like rich spectrum of like people who are just kind of like laying bare their souls on like the walls. And then you get like the little creeping ways in which like in Black Panthers, like the ways in which like the, you know, there are outside like kind of nefarious forces that are trying to unravel like, you know, what makes this community special. Like there's the thing about like how like the building owner like made them cut the mural in half so that, you know, it would like quit obstructing this view, or like the kind of like gentrifying area where they're like doing infill development of like the empty lots that are like basically putting buildings on top of the existing murals. And so like on the one hand, you get like this extremely vibrant and interesting just like cross section of like all these people who are involved in like street art and mural making. And then at the same time, you have like the official status of the city like kind of coming in and either like co-opting it or hiding it, which like that was one thing that struck me. When like in like 2020, when it's like every city is like unveiling some sort of like mural, is like, look at our big mural celebrating Knoxville or whatever, like how deeply personal these expressions were, which I think like public art doesn't get deeply personal very often, because nowadays a lot of public art is like publicly funded to just kind of decorate like gentrifying inner cities, and this kind of catches the like mural making at that really interesting point at which you can start seeing those like forces start to put pressure on like the whole movement, but you still have the kind of really deeply personally invested people in it as well, which isn't to like besmirch like actual artists who work now either, but I'm just thinking of like when cities allow murals to exist now or like kind of tout their murals, they're not really touting murals that are like the ones in this movie, which are so like interesting and weird and personal. Like they're usually aiming for something more universal, which is like, feels really like, I don't know, like corporatized or safe in a way that these murals don't.
There's that section, I forgot what specific mural they're talking about, but they're talking about like why they like having this mural in their neighborhood compared to the billboards. And then Varda cuts to like all these different like billboards along the highway of different things, and then cuts to the mural and how it's, you just have that much more personal approach. And I was thinking of that just in terms, again, to my personal experience where, like, for instance, like here in Savannah, they're very proud of this mural that they did kind of on the, it's like when you're coming off the highway, there's this, you know, welcome to Savannah public mural that, I mean, it's nice, but it's also, it's pretty much a billboard. It's not like some personal public art that somebody did just to kind of express themselves in this neighborhood. It's, you know, the tourism board commissioned it and got a local artist to do it, but it's pretty much just like a billboard. And so that's what they're like talking about, like that they like having in that portion, they like having that more personal public art that, like, yeah, it's just, it's kind of strange, but it's unique to that area, and it's not just like billboards and you know, corporatization all over the place. Which again, that guy, that just was, you know, incredibly inspiring to me watching it. But Nathan, what did you make of the documentary?
You know, it's interesting. I think of all the Varda films I've seen, I mean, it reminds me the most of Faces Places, just that sort of interest in like large scale public art, and particularly public art that sort of celebrates the stories of individuals. And it even sort of uses some similar visual techniques where you like have the artist, you know, like very small, framed against their sort of giant work. And she seems very interested in particular in murals that depict people in some way. But one of the, it has a very relaxing rhythm, like you were saying, Zach. You know, it has this sort of like PBS quality to it. And I think it's more interesting to me, honestly, than something like Faces Places, just because it's sort of a city film. You know, it's using the murals to sort of explore different neighborhoods. But one of the things about it that I did kind of find maybe a little weaker is just that it sort of, the film sort of varies from mural to mural. And so it's just, I guess it just sort of speaks to sort of like the nature of cities, but it's just interesting how you have these sort of certain murals that are like very politically resonant and have a like very deep social message, but then you have like other murals that are just, you know, like this guy's wife and like, you know, the owner of a like wedding gown store, like, you know, on the wall of his business, or like things like that, you know, art that has more of a commercial purpose or maybe is more personal, you know, as opposed to sort of political. So I don't know, it's sort of interesting to me, just the, like, I guess the sort of representation of functions of public art. You know, there are some that are very clearly statements, and then there are others that are sort of monuments, you know, sort of trying to capture some kind of moment in time or some kind of slice of a person. And then there are others that are just like, you know, more abstract. So it's yeah, I don't know, you know, it's really interesting to see, I guess, how the sort of artworks themselves influence and sort of define the formal qualities of the movie itself. I think, you know, I feel like she kind of takes the structure and style from the art that she's filming.
No, absolutely. And I think you're right. Like the, and they mentioned it in the New York Times review, but I think that the best moments are when she just kind of lets the camera move around and you just kind of study the mural as if you were standing there on the street or whatever, looking at it in person. There's nothing I feel like in turn, like if you're like, well, what about this is like engaging necessarily like as a dog? And like, there's nothing really like innovative in it. It's just, she's literally just bouncing around to these different neighborhoods, talking to people and looking at these murals. I think on the surface, it's kind of boring. This person outside my apartment disagrees, but, yeah, it's just, it's very just kind of meandering. And there's something that's, I think that's like adds to the comfort. It's, there's something comforting in that meandering quality that it has.
There's a interesting part, the part where towards the end, but not super near the end, sort of the last maybe third of the film, there's a part where there's that group of people who are doing like the pop-up mural sort of thing, that like slash performance where they're setting things on fire. Yeah, that was sort of interesting because it was one of the few moments I felt like that the documentary became stylized in a way. I just felt like the way that that was filmed was, or rather, like edited, it was like edited in such a way that was sort of chaotic, that sort of reflected the what was happening on screen. It just sort of stood out to me because I felt like the rest of the documentary was so sort of distant and just kind of depicting things as they were and as they came. It was just sort of an interesting moment.
Say, I like those moments when, like, the mural painting intersects, like, other forms. Like, you mentioned Zach, the punk band that, like, makes an appearance, which is cool. And then, of course, there's that, like, the performance art, like, mixing with the mural painting as well. Because I think it, like, situates it within a larger context, which is, like, also, like, really interesting to me. Because, like, a lot of times I think, like, people view murals as like, oh, that's just on the wall. Like, it's kind of like a, like something that's static. And so to put it within like dynamic context is really fun in this movie.
Nathan, you mentioned Faces Places. This one, I feel like I agree. This is kind of in kinship with that, but I think, and we talked about this in the first episode of the series, but you know, Faces Places, like you have like this element of it where like you have this public art and they're engaging with like these different communities, but then you also have like the kind of faux narrative aspect of it as well. And I think I like this more than Faces Places just because I like that all of the, like the interact, like the quote narrative of it was all like just was much more like documentary, like them, like her talking with people. It didn't have like that kind of that fiction to it that Faces Places has that kind of distracts you from what's effective about that movie.
Oh, for sure.
Any other thoughts on murals before we wrap up? You know, we're gonna be doing the Gleaners and I, which I feel like is kind of a much more late period encapsulation of Varda after this. But I mean, I don't know, like looking at the two films that we talked about for this part, I mean, I don't know, as kind of LA movies or city movies, would do you feel like they were effective in that sense, since you have this, the, you know, the French woman bouncing around LA in the 60s, 70s and 80s?
Well, she also goes to Oakland too. Right. Isn't Black Panthers in Oakland?
It's all California, you know, whatever. It's all the...
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. Like, I think, like, one of the things that America doesn't get, or at least Americans don't see very often, or at least I don't see very often, is, like, the, like, an outsider view of, like, what America is. You know, we get kind of, like, the exaggerated stereotypes of, like, Americans, like, you know, in the really broad strokes. But, like, to have a French person or someone from anywhere else, like, come and make a documentary about some stuff going on in our country in the same way that, like, you know, I don't know, someone else would go into another country and we would watch their documentary about, like, to learn about, like, you know, oh, I don't know, I want to learn about the 68 student protests in France, you know, and I'm an American. I think it's interesting to have the tables flipped just because I don't think that we get those tables flipped very often, just because of, like, the consolidation of, like, the film industry within the United States and then the resistance toward, like, you know, foreign distribution and stuff.
Yeah. And we're also just arrogant and don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I basically don't care what other people think about our country. I'm going to hate it by myself, darn it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was also just thinking kind of like as a portrait of, like a portrait of L.A. L.A.'s, you know, filmed in so many, you know, vastly different ways that it's kind of interesting to see it through the lens of Agnes Varda.
Well, and I think that's also another interesting thing. Like, you know, there's like the mythologized LA and like the LA that like people are familiar with, you know, Hollywood Hills and like whatever like that. Like when I think of LA, like I think about like, I've never been there, but I think about like, you know, the Walk of Fame or like that stupid Hollywood sign, and that sort of thing. And, you know, or maybe like if I'm thinking like hip hop, like Compton or something, which I guess is briefly mentioned here. And I think that like LA is such a big sprawling place, you know, there's like whatever, like 6 million people living there. And I feel like the most common images of that are not of the majority of those 6 million people. And this movie maybe gets closer to that just because it's like defamiliarizing, a city that is like in some ways very familiar.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Cause I feel like it gets kind of this specific lens. And I don't know, we've seen it so many different ways through, you know, American filmmakers that I think it's just kind of interesting to see this perspective and this way of viewing, especially city, you know, parts of the city that probably aren't as highlighted as you mentioned, you know, through film. So yeah. Well, both of these are on the Criterion channel. Again, Criterion, if you'd like to sponsor us, please, you know, hit me up. We'll be happy to oblige by that. But, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we put all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Head over to patreon.com/cinematary. We're going to have a new Patreon episode coming up. We'll hopefully get a new Film Theory and Chill coming out soon. And then we also have, I did a quick chat with the author... film author Dan Callahan about his book on Alfred Hitchcock and his work with his actors. Good chat that you'll find. I'll be putting that on the Patreon page, both in audio form and the full transcription. So it's an interesting chat for fans of Hitchcock and old Hollywood and such. So if you would like to catch all of that content, you can go to patreon.com/cinematary. But thank you to our patrons so far. Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Hell Yeah Small World, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Pedro Seraphim, Ron Hayes, The Kittiest of Kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Like I mentioned before, next week we will be wrapping up our Agnes Varda series with 2000's The Gleaners and I. So yeah, we'll also be announcing our October horror series that we'll be doing as well. So exciting time. So be sure to check out cinematary.com and check out those new reviews I mentioned at the top. But until next week, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you then.